This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After about 20 years of counseling men who batter women, psychologist Donald Dutton has tried to answer the question, what made them that way? Dutton presents a psychological profile of the abusive man in his new book, The Batterer. Dutton directs the Assaultive Husbands Program in Vancouver. He testified in the O.J. Simpson pretrial hearing and was the prosecution's sole domestic violence expert to take the stand in the Simpson case. Dutton is particularly interested in what he calls the cyclical batterer, the man who alternates between periods of tension, abuse, and contrition. He says that women often assume that the contrition phase, in which the man is attentive and apologetic, represents his real personality, and that's one reason why women often stay.
When this happens the first time, what this woman has seen by and large has been the good guy. That's been the one who's wooed her, who's courted her. When the violence erupts the first time, it generally comes out of the blue, and it's really a shock. It doesn't fit in with the rest of what she knows about this man. And so it does seem like an aberration. And then when he goes back to being the good guy again, she begins to believe that that was just some kind of passing aberration and it's not going to happen again. And these men can be very convincing at this particular point in terms of their proclamations about changing, and some of them are genuinely sorry that it happened. It's just that they don't really know how to change it. And I mean, my advice to a woman who has this happen to her would be to insist at the very beginning of the relationship that this man get help right away, that she doesn't want this to happen again, and to make sure that he both takes initiative for getting help, by which I mean group treatment is probably the best thing, and that he doesn't backslide from the treatment. And he completes it, in other words.
Do you think it's a mistake to assume that the nicer cycle, the contrition cycle, is the real personality, and that the violent part is the aberration, the part that isn't the real man?
They're both real. I mean, I can't tell you how many women have come in and described their husband as Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. These are both real aspects of this man's personality. They have origins very early in this man's development, probably before the age of 2, in fact, which is kind of shocking to some people.
Are most of the men who you see referred by the criminal justice system?
The bulk of them, about 80 to 90%, come through the courts, yes. They've been convicted in court of wife assault.
So that means they don't necessarily feel that they need to change. They've been told they need to change, but that feeling's not coming from within.
Yeah, that's right, and that's a major problem working with court-mandated men, is that you have to spend a lot of time in the beginning getting this man to realize that there's costs attached to his abusiveness. Now, most men who come through the courts have been violent more than once. I mean, it's rare to actually get somebody who comes in on a first assault, and sometimes that happens, but more typically there's been a history of assault and it's just finally got to the point where it reached police attention. And so one of the things you want to do is to do a really thorough assessment with the man's female partner to find out how much violence is there. You need this man to see what the costs and consequences of his violence are on his partner. You also need him to see what the costs and consequences of his violence are on any children he might have and on himself, because people who are consistently approaching the world with that kind of high level of irritability and anger are creating a kind of corticosteroid pool for themselves that's really not very healthy, and it's got negative health costs. So you spend a lot of time just sort of showing them that there's a lot of costs attached to their anger, and you have to sort of sell them on the idea that the treatment is worthwhile for them.
What are some of the justifications you've heard men make for beating up their wives?
She nagged me too much. She does, I keep telling her not to do drugs, and she does drugs. The house is a mess all the time. I come home, I work 10 hours a day. She's got nothing to do here. I come back, and the place is a pigsty. She doesn't look after the kids properly. Those are the main ones.
And they think it's okay to beat their wives because of that behavior.
Well, yeah, yes and no. I mean, most men don't actually think that what they do is okay. They'll say, I realize I shouldn't have done that. It was a wrong thing to do. I lost it, or I lost my temper. I mean, they'll find some way to make it sound like they lost control of the situation, but they don't actually view the actions that they took as being acceptable. I mean, there's some exceptions to that, but I would say 95% of men who come in for their initial assessment don't feel that what they did was all right.
This is often the man's first time in therapy.
Yeah, most of them. The only exception to that is if some of these men have been to AA meetings. That's the only exception. Apart from that, it's their first experience with therapy, so they've got all kinds of male dread about having to talk about their feelings in front of other men, and that's why the opening night is really, when you walk into the group on opening night, you can cut the air with a knife practically. It's so tense in there. It's only after everybody's told their story that you begin to get this process of bonding that starts to go on and people begin to relax a little bit.
Tell us what an opening night is like.
You walk into the room, there's supposed to be 12 clients there. At least 4 of them will be late because it's first night and they can't find the place. So the other 8 will be tremendously uptight. And you'll get a clear example how they deal with their anxiety. Some of them will be sitting there staring straight down at the floor. Others will be pacing around. Others will be outside smoking cigarettes and trying to calm their nerves. I've had everything from men on opening night challenge my co-therapist's credentials and say, "You're psychoanalyzing me," and then bolt out of the room, to men taking on other men in the group on opening night, just because they convert the anxiety into anger, and driving the other men out of the room, to men breaking down in tears over what they did. So, I mean, the one thing I think you could say to describe what goes on, and there's a high level of emotion in there on opening night.
During this opening night, when men are telling their stories, and you hear something that's really horrifying, what do you say?
We asked them. We would first of all ask the man how he felt about that, he himself. And then we would probably ask the other men in the room how they felt about it. And you get a mixture of things. I mean, you will get men saying, "Boy, I thought I had a problem with violence, boy, until I heard what this guy said." And then you have to work on that, because you have to also confront this man on the fact that he can sort of dodge his own issues by pointing to someone he sees as being worse off as a way of not working on his own issues, okay? But with the horrifying stuff, I think the opening night, you basically, all you want to do is hear how people feel about it, including the transgressor himself. Now, maybe 3 or 4 weeks down the line, when you've been working with these men a little bit more, see, what you're trying to do is this. Rather than globally shame the man about what he's done, what you want to really keep focusing on is how he can change those specific behaviors. And again, I have to reiterate that most of these men find these behaviors unacceptable themselves. And so you have to keep going back to that. What we sometimes ask men to do, in fact, we frequently ask them to do that, is to write a personal violence policy. That is, we ask them, under what circumstances in your life do you think it's okay to use violence? And they have to come in with it. They have to think about it all week and bring in a written statement the next week. Now, most men will say things like, "If I felt someone was attacking my family, I think it would be okay to use violence to defend my family." Or, "If someone was attacking me, I think it would be okay to use violence in self-defense." And so then what we've got from them at that point is their own statement of their own values and their own policy. And in all the weeks that follow after that, we'll keep going back to that. So if they do something that doesn't fit their own policy, we'll keep pointing out the differences to them between their own actions and what they say their policy is. And we get them to commit to the fact that this is what they want their policy to be. And I think that's important, because this way it's coming more from the man rather than something that's imposed from outside by the therapist.
How honest are men, though, when they fill out that personal policy?
Well, we spend a lot of time asking them about it. We go over every aspect of it, and we say, "Well, you're sure now this? Well, what about if this happened? And you know, do you think it's okay to use violence if you're really feeling cornered and your wife is winning an argument?" And I mean, all we can do is get from them a personal statement of how they think they should behave. And then we just keep going back and forth between how they are behaving and how they feel they should behave. And sometimes, partway through the group, some men will revise the policy a little bit. They'll say, "Yeah, well, you know, I didn't think about this, or I didn't think about that." But by and large, with some exceptions, and I will say there's some cultural exceptions, but by and large, most men do not feel that it's all right to beat their wives.
One of the points you make in your book is that you can't blame the alcohol for turning a man into an abuser.
That's right. I think, you know, I mean, alcohol, what men do when they get drunk and I made this point in the group, can vary from, you know, singing in the shower to giving their money away to, in some cases, becoming violent. And if the man becomes violent when he's drunk, then what that alcohol is doing is disinhibiting a learned action pattern that that man carries around with him, which happens to be violent. I think in the development of an abusive personality, there's a number of things we have to pay attention to. These men experience a lot of trauma symptoms, surprisingly enough. Dysphoric states, sleep disturbances, depression, anxiety. One of the reasons why they drink is to blot out these bad feelings that they go through. That's also one of the reasons why they hit, because when they hit, they get rid of the anxiety, they get rid of all the pent-up tension. They act it out, they blow it out, they feel better after, although it's obviously had destructive consequences. So there's a kind of personality connection between both the substance abuse and the wife abuse. On top of that, if they're using alcohol, which has disinhibiting properties, then that makes it all the much easier for them to act out physically. So that is what I see as being the connection between the alcohol and the physical abuse, but it's not the man drinks and then there's a direct sort of billiard ball determinism connection between that and violence.
My guest is Donald Dutton. He directs the Assaultive Husband Program in Vancouver. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Donald Dutton, author of the new book, The Batterer, A Psychological Profile. Are there any generalizations you can make about psychological problems that most abusers share?
Yeah, the main one, from our research, they've obviously got, you know, self-esteem. I mean, self-esteem problems, that one seems pretty self-evident. But to go beyond that, they have almost pathological jealousy, like pathological concerns about being abandoned, which I see as having attachment origins, that there was really shaky attachment that went on when they were growing up. And I think one of the reasons for that is that in many cases they had mothers who were themselves trying to deal with abusive husbands, and so the attachment was very intermittent. When you get that kind of positive-negative attachment, you develop someone who's really ambivalent about intimate relationships. They both strongly need them, and they're all strongly afraid of them at the same time. They convert the fear part into anger, and so when they're in an intimate relationship that they need, they experience anger just as a consequence of attachment. They don't understand their anger in those terms, so they tend to blame it on things that their partner does and to make her the scapegoat for the things that they're feeling. But these men feel angry whenever they get close to a woman. They feel a sense of ongoing irritability out of closeness. So the jealousy is kind of a focused aspect of this fear of abandonment, because the man tends to think about it in sexual terms, and then that makes jealousy the main thing that he experiences. So he takes this sort of broader set of abandonment fears and narrows them down into feeling jealous.
I wonder if you've given any thought to how much of spousal abuse has to do with larger political, social, economic factors like, you know, misogyny in our culture, and how much of it is purely psychological, the upbringing that a man had, the environment he grew up in, and the impact that that's had on him.
I've given a lot of thought to that, because when I started doing this work, the sort of prevailing thought in those days was that it was all basically a socio-political explanation. It was basically misogyny, period. And what troubled me about that explanation is that there's so much heterogeneity amongst men that you can't really explain that heterogeneity. Since they're all growing up within the same culture, it raises a question of why men are so different. So I think, I mean, to answer your question, I think that the origins of abusiveness develop early on and are therefore psychological, and they develop in families where boys are shamed by their fathers, have insecure attachment with their mothers, and frequently have physically violent role models that they can pattern their behavior after as a way of acting out anger. And that, given that sort of psychological substratum, if you will, these men then go on to take on different aspects of the culture that really reinforce who they are. For example, a boy who's got a propensity to be abusive, who's, say, 16 or 17 years old, gets extremely jealous and dependent with his girlfriend, blows the relationship out of the water, blames her for it, finds another girlfriend, does the same thing again, blames her for it. Eventually, instead of blaming girlfriend A, B, C, he generalizes his blame to all women. And we find that abusive men have distinctively more negative attitudes towards women than do non-abusive men. Now, I think these men, in other words, shop around in the culture, the ambient culture, for negative beliefs about women, which they then use to justify their own abusiveness, so they get socialized differently.
So
the psychology and the sociology interact. Mm-hmm. The psychology is first, and it's primary, and it then shapes the way that the man adjusts to whatever the culture has to offer him.
Now, how much contact do you have with the wives or lovers of the abusive men in your groups?
Well, first of all, as soon as a man starts treatment, the first thing we do is go over and spend 2 or 3 hours talking to each one of the women about the entire relationship, about the man. We get her to fill in a number of descriptive scales about her husband. We spend a lot of time talking to her about what she would do if he became violent again. We go through a kind of re-victimization prevention program with her, going through a number of safety things that she can do, convincing her that it probably is a good idea to call 911, finding out if there's a locked room in the house where she could get to that has a telephone, if she's got support groups around, those kind of things. And then we basically have a kind of phone-in policy that she can call us, and we invite her to call us and keep us posted on how things are going. We'll usually see them maybe two more times, once during the time the man's in the group and once at the end of group, although there's exceptions to that. I mean, some women just get really involved. I mean, one woman in one of our groups drove the guy down to his treatment group every night, waited for him to complete it, and drove him back again at the end of the night. She really wanted to make sure that he was going to complete it. So again, there's individual variation, but the norm would be that we would see each one of them three times and keep phone contact between.
Do you often find that you get a completely different point of view about what's happening in the relationship when you talk with the woman than heard from the man?
Oh, yeah. Sometimes you get completely different points of view. And that's sort of, in some cases, I guess, a measure of the man's denial. I mean, we work on the assumption, and not that everything the woman's going to tell us is gospel truth, but we think she's got less of a reason to gloss things over than he does. I mean, he's the one who's done something wrong, and he's the one who's being treated. And occasionally, I mean, you meet women, and it's just a completely different picture from what the man painted. And other times, there isn't really that much difference. It's the guy's giving you a pretty accurate picture of what things are like at home.
Can you give me an example of where it was a different picture?
Well, I met one man who, you know, kind of really depicted his wife as this kind of incompetent, couldn't look after the kids, just didn't have her own act together. And I met this woman who was with this guy, and she was so together that I thought this one would actually make a very good therapist. I mean, she had complete insight into herself, complete insight into him. She was a very sort of thorough person, both in her professional life, which he hadn't even told me about, that she had a job outside the home, and in terms of looking after the kids. She had just a real clear sort of philosophy for child rearing, etc. She was just a completely different person than what he'd described.
Did you take this information back to him and challenge him?
Well, yeah, you have to be careful in what you do with that. I mean, one obvious example is if the man says, well, I've stopped being violent, and you interview the woman and find out that's not true. I mean, the temptation is to run back into the next group and say, well, I talked to your wife 3 days ago, and she says you're still hitting her. Well, of course, if you do that, you can put the woman at risk again. But what you want to do is to find other ways. You know, usually you will interview the man in a little bit more depth at the end of that particular group, and the person who interviews him will not be the person that he knows interviewed his wife. So therapist A will have interviewed his wife. Therapist B will say to the man, so, you know, how are things going in your relationship these days? And you'll try and draw him out a little bit more. You use a kind of graduated system of techniques. But, I mean, if the man is not coming forward, we have gone to the point, in some cases, of actually whipping out the police report and reading the police report to him in group, saying, you know, you're telling us you don't have a problem with violence. Look at what it says here. Now, why are the police trying to lie to us? You know, why have they got anything to gain from lying to us? So it sounds to us like you're really not fessing up.
My guest is Donald Dutton. He directs the Assaultive Husband Program in Vancouver. We'll talk more in a minute. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Donald Dutton, author of the new book, The Batterer, A Psychological Profile. You were an expert witness in the O.J. Simpson trial for the prosecution.
Yes.
And this was in the pretrial?
Yes, it was a pretrial motion. Ironically enough, the defense, it was the defense that brought family violence into the Simpson case by filing a pretrial motion that claimed that they simply didn't want any reference to domestic violence used in court at all. They didn't want wife assault or wife battery or stalking or any of those terms used in court because they said they were highly prejudicial. They wanted the only term that the defense deemed acceptable was the term domestic discord. So they wanted to portray what went on between O.J. Simpson and Nicole Brown Simpson as a kind of mutual combat tiff that would occur quite typically between couples. The prosecution, of course, at that point had to file a counterbrief, and that's where I got called in. And what we did in the counterbrief was to point out that if you looked at studies of spousal homicides, now, if you looked at studies actually of all women being killed, you found half of them were spousal homicides. And when you looked at the spousal homicides, you found there'd always, 90% of the time, had been a recorded history of physical abuse that that couple had been experiencing from the man to the woman, that the man was described as being extremely jealous, that there was a history of separations and reconciliations for that couple, and that the woman typically was killed by what's described as overkill, that is, she was typically stabbed repeatedly with a knife. And so the argument that the prosecution wanted to make was that the signature characteristics of spousal homicides fitted this particular case, and therefore the domestic violence evidence was relevant.
Did you think that the patterns of domestic violence fit the O.J. Simpson case?
I did, yes, and still do.
How did you prepare for being an expert witness?
Well, the funny thing is I had no preparation at all because up until 10 minutes before I took the stand, we didn't know whether I was going to take the stand or not. So I basically was flying by the seat of my pants. Fortunately, I think everyone else in the courtroom was at that point, too, including Lee Bailey, who cross-examined me. I think if it had happened 4 or 5 months later with more preparation, it would have been a much tougher cross-examination. But basically, Bailey kept trying to get me to admit that someone who was the captain of the football team and therefore an upstanding citizen could not possibly be a wife batterer, which, of course, is completely the opposite to what we know to be the truth.
What do you know to be the truth?
What we know to be the truth is that men who are wife batterers have two personalities, and the private one is completely distinct from the public one. And I don't think there's any case that made this more salient than the O.J. Simpson case because, I mean, it's not in dispute that there was violence that took place between him and Nicole Brown Simpson. And I'm not talking about whether he killed her or not. I'm talking about the battering incidents in 1989, you know, and the 911 call in 1993. When people heard that 911 call and heard him sort of ranting in the background, it was really startling for a lot of people who had this sort of smiling image of O.J., you know, as the front man for a variety of sponsorships. And then hearing the discrepancy between the two was shocking. But that really is what abusive personalities are about.
You know, abusive men fool the women in their lives. You know, when go through the period of apology and contrition. Do they fool the therapist, too? Do you get fooled?
I don't think so. I mean, they don't fool us. We're pretty cynical. And we've seen most of the excuses and, you know, most of the con jobs. I've been doing therapy with battering men since 1979. So it's pretty rare for us to get fooled. You know, and basically, I think one of the reasons for that is that whatever the man says is fine. We're going to work with him in group, but we're really looking for him to walk the walk rather than just talk the talk. And until we've got evidence from his wife that he's doing that, and he stopped being abusive, and this is fairly consistent, then I don't think we get fooled. I mean, I think in the early days we got fooled a few times, but not so much anymore.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Donald Dutton directs the Assaultive Husbands Program in Vancouver and is a psychology professor at the University of British Columbia. He's the author of the book The Batterer, A Psychological Profile.